The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the January-February 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, titled 1968, The Year That Shattered America. And we'll begin with an article titled Dethroning Miss America by Roxane Gay. The Star-Spangled Pageant became a surprise battleground in the fight for women's rights and racial equality. The Miss America pageant has never been a progressive event, but in 1968, it sparked a feminist revolution. As women organized the first protest against Miss America, they were responding not only to the pageant and its antiquated, misogynistic attitudes toward women and beauty, but also to how the United States as a whole treated women. The 1968 uprising was conceived by a radical feminist named Carol Hanisch, who popularized the phrase, "The personal is political." Disrupting the beauty contest, she thought, in the summer of that year, just might be the way to bring the fledgling women's liberation movement into the public arena. Like so many things, the Miss America pageant began as a marketing scheme. Held in Atlantic City just after Labor Day, it started in 1921 as a way for newspapers to increase their circulation and for the resort's businesses to extend their profitable summer season. Newspapers across the country held contests judging photographs of young women, and the winners came to Atlantic City for a competition where they were evaluated on, quote, personality and social graces, unquote. There was no equivocating. Women's beauty, white women's beauty, was a tool. Since its inception, the pageant has evolved in some ways and not so much in others. The talent competition was introduced in 1938 so that perhaps the young women could be judged on more than just their appearance. But with that small bit of progress came regression. That same year, the pageant chose to limit eligibility to single, never married women between the ages of 18 and 28. The kind of beauty the pageant wanted to reward was very specific and very narrow. That of the demure, slender, but not too thin woman, the girl next door with a bright white smile, a flirtatious but not overly coquettish manner, smart but not too smart, certainly heterosexual. There was even a Rule 7, abandoned in 1940, that stated that Miss America contestants had to be of, quote, good health and of the white race, unquote. The winners spent the day doing community service, but also peddling sponsors' products and later entertaining U.S. troops. To Hanisch and other protest organizers, the pageant was an obvious target. On August 22nd, the New York Radical Women issued a press release inviting, quote-unquote, women of every political persuasion to the Atlantic City Boardwalk on September 7th, the day of the contest. They would, quote, protest the image of Miss America, an image that oppresses women in every area in which it purports to represent us, unquote. The protest would feature a, quote-unquote, freedom trash can, into which women could throw away all the physical manifestations of women's oppression, such as, quote, bras, girdles, curlers, false eyelashes, wigs, and representative issues of Cosmopolitan, Ladies' Home Journal, Family Circle, etc., unquote. The organizers also proposed a concurrent boycott of companies whose products were used in or sponsored the pageant. Male reporters would not be allowed to interview protesters, which remains one of the loveliest details of the protest. The organizers also issued a document offering 10 reasons why they were protesting, with detailed explanations, a woman-festo, if you will. One contention was, quote, the degrading, mindless boob girly symbol, unquote. Another was racism, since a woman of color had never won, and there had never been a black contestant. Nor, quote, has there ever been a true Miss America, an American Indian, quote, they wrote. They also protested the military-industrial complex and the role of Miss America as a, quote, death mascot, unquote, in entertaining the troops. They pointed to the consumeristic nature of corporate sponsorship of the pageant and the valuing of beauty as a measure of woman's worth. They lamented that with the crowning of every new Miss America, the previous winner was forced into pop culture obsolescence. They rejected the double standard that contestants were forced to be, quote, both sexy and wholesome, delicate but able to cope, demure, let titillatingly B-word, unquote. The pageant represented the elevation of mediocrity. American women were encouraged to be, quote, unoffensive, bland, apolitical, unquote, and instill this impoverished ambition in young girls. No more Miss America, the woman Festo proclaimed. The organizers obtained a permit detailing their plans for the protest, including barring men from participating, and on the afternoon of September 7th, a few hundred women marched on the Atlantic City boardwalk, just outside the convention center where the pageant took place. Protesters held signs with such statements as, all women are beautiful, cattle parades are demeaning to human beings, don't be a Playboy accessory, can makeup hide the wounds of our oppression? The protesters adopted guerrilla theater tactics, too. One woman performed a skit, holding her child in pots and pans, mopping the boardwalk to exemplify how a woman's work is never done. A prominent black feminist activist and lawyer, Florence Kennedy, who went by Flo, chained herself to a puppet of Miss America to highlight the ways women were enslaved by beauty standards. Robin Morgan, also a protest organizer, later quoted Kennedy as comparing that summer's violent protests at the Democratic National Convention to throwing a brick through a window. Quote, the Atlantic City action, Kennedy continued, is comparable to peeing on an expensive rug at a polite cocktail party. The man never expects the second kind of protest, and very often that's the one that really gets him uptight, end quote. The Freedom Trash Can was a prominent feature, and the commentary about its role in the protest gave rise to one of the greatest misrepresentations of women's liberation, the myth of ceremonial bra burning. It was a compelling image, angry, unshaven feminists, their breasts free from constraint, setting fire to their bras as they dared to demand their own liberation. But it never actually happened. In fact, officials asked the women not to set the can on fire because the wooden boardwalk was quite flammable. The myth can be traced back to the New York Post reporter Lindsay Van Gelder, who, in a piece before the protest, suggested protesters would burn bras, a nod to the burning of draft cards. After other Post writers reported the idea as fact, syndicated humor columnist Art Buchwald spread the myth nationally. The final and most tragic part of the protest, he wrote, quote, took place when several of the women publicly burned their brassieres, end quote. He continued to revel in his misogyny, writing, quote, if the average American female gave up all her beauty products, she would look like Tiny Tim, and there would be no reason for the American male to have anything to do with her at all, end quote. In a handful of sentences, Buchwald neatly illustrated the urgent need for the protest. During the actual pageant that evening, some of the protesters, including Carol Hanisch, sneaked into Boardwalk Hall and unfurled a banner reading, Women's Liberation, while shouting, Women's Liberation and No More Miss America. Their action gave the burgeoning movement an invaluable amount of exposure during the live broadcast. At midnight on September 8th, a few blocks away at the Atlantic City Ritz-Carlton, the inaugural Miss Black America competition was held. If the Miss America pageant wouldn't accommodate black women and black beauty, black folk decided that they would create their own pageant. After his daughters expressed their desire to be Miss America, the Philadelphia entrepreneur J. Morris Anderson created Miss Black America so his children's ambitions would not be thwarted by American racism. The 1968 winner, Sandra Williams, reveled in her win. Quote, Miss America does not represent us because there has never been a black girl in the pageant, she said afterward. With my title, I can show black women that they, too, are beautiful, end quote. In 1971, Oprah Winfrey participated in Miss Black America as Miss Tennessee. The pageant, which continues today, is the oldest pageant in the country for women of color. While the 1968 protests may not have done much to change the nature of the Miss America pageant, they did introduce feminism into the mainstream consciousness and expand the national conversation about the rights and liberation of women. The first wave of feminism, which focused on suffrage, began in the late 19th century. Many historians now credit the 68 protest as the beginning of feminism's broader second wave. As feminists are wont to do, the organizers were later relentless in critiquing their own efforts. In November 1968, Carol Hanisch wrote that, quote, one of the biggest mistakes of the whole pageant was our anti-womanism. Miss America and all beautiful women came off as our enemy instead of our sisters who suffer with us, end quote. History is cyclical. Women are still held to restrictive beauty standards. Certainly, the cultural definition of beauty has expanded over the years, but it has not been blown wide open. White women are still upheld as an ideal of beauty. In the Miss America competition, women are still forced to parade around in swimsuits and high heels. Quote, the swimsuit competition is probably the most honest part of the competition because it really is about bodies. It is about looking as women as objects, quote, Gloria Steinem said in the 2002 film Miss America. History is cyclical. As we look back on these 1968 protests, we are in the midst of another significant cultural moment led by women. After the election and inauguration of President Trump, millions of women and their allies marched into the nation's capital and in cities around the world to reaffirm women's rights and the rights of all marginalized people as human rights. They marched for many of the same rights the 1968 protesters were seeking. A year later, we are in the midst of a further reckoning as women come forward to share their stories of workplace sexual harassment and sexual violence. And for the first time, men are facing real consequences for the predation. The connective tissue between 1968 and now is stronger than ever, vibrantly alive. Now we'll move on to an article titled The Man Who Invented the Future by Valerie Landau. Two decades before the personal computer, a shy engineer unveiled the tools that would drive the tech revolution. A close colleague looks back on his vision. On December 8, 1968, Douglas Engelbart sat in front of a crowd of 1,000 in San Francisco, ready to introduce networked computing to the world. Engelbart was no Steve Jobs. He was a shy engineer with no marketing background. His goal was to speak directly to other engineers, showing them that they could use computers in new ways to solve complex human problems. That message was radical enough in 1968. Most programmers of the day used punch cards to carry out quantitative tasks like tabulating census data, writing banking code, or calculating a missile's trajectory. Even in the futuristic 2001 A Space Odyssey, which came out in April 1968, the HAL 9000 was an enhanced version of the same thing. It could play chess and make small talk with crew members and ultimately sabotage the whole mission, but its job was still to compute numbers and run systems. HAL didn't give its users a way to write, design, or collaborate on documents. Engelbart didn't just come up with the notion of using computers to solve the urgent and multifaceted problems facing humanity. He also gave the first ever live demonstration of network personal computing. Today, it's known as the mother of all demos, a precursor to every technology presentation that's happened since, and arguably more ambitious than any of them. When Engelbart walked on stage, he was wearing a headset with a microphone so he could talk to other members of his team at the Stanford Research Institute in Menlo Park. Engelbart's team ran 30 miles of cables over the highways into San Francisco. In order to project the demo onto a 22-foot by 18-foot screen, they borrowed a projector from NASA. Engelbart started with a provocative question. If in your office, you, as an intellectual worker, were supplied with a computer display backed up by a computer that was alive for you all day and was instantly responsive to every action you have, how much value could you derive from that? Then he began to type, using a keyboard with numbers and letters instead of inputting information with a punch card. Text appeared on the screen. Word, 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 word. If I make some mistakes, I can back up a little bit, he noted, proudly showing off his new delete function. He announced that this was going to save the document. Oh, I need a name, he explained, and he titled it Sample File. He showed that he could copy the text and paste it again and again. Next, Engelbart pulled up a shopping list on the screens. Apples, bananas, soup, beans. He moved the items up and down the list with simple clicks, organizing produce with produce, canned goods with canned goods, dairy with dairy. But there's another thing I can do, he declared. He pulled up a map of his route home, with stops along the way. Library. What am I supposed to do there? He asked. A click on the word pulled up another list. Oh, I see. Overdue books. He went back to the map and clicked on the word drugstore. Another list popped up, showing items like aspirin and chapstick. It wasn't just the software that was revolutionary. Engelbart had also invented a new tracking device with the help of Bill English, an engineer on his team. As the small device rolled, a dot on the screen rolled along with it. I don't know why we call it a mouse, Engelbart remarked. Sometimes I apologize. It started that way and we never did change it. Engelbart called his program the Online System, or NLS. His larger goal, beyond any of the specific functions he'd introduced, was for people to collaborate. Toward the end of his presentation, he alluded to an experimental network that would allow different users to collaborate from as far away as Harvard and Stanford. He was describing the ARPANET, A-R-P-A-N-E-T, a program that was just starting to burgeon at the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, ARPA, under the U.S. Department of Defense. Engelbart expected his presentation to attract hundreds of engineers eager to join him in this new wave of computing. He had, after all, introduced word processing, document sharing, version control, and hyperlinks. And he integrated text, graphics, and video conferencing. It even foreshadowed the internet. He thought the audience members would line up afterwards to ask how they could join his network and help develop his ideas. Instead, they gave him a standing ovation and then filed out of the auditorium. I found out about Engelbart almost by accident. In 1986, when I was working on a TV show about Silicon Valley for the PBS station in San Jose. I was looking for B-roll footage in the Stanford Library when Henry Lowood, a librarian, mentioned a film reel he had from a computer demonstration in 1968. I was riveted. After our program aired, Engelbart asked us to produce a video about his ideas. We never did make that video, but as I sat down to talk to him, I realized that what he was describing could actually change the world. I went to graduate school at Harvard and studied educational technology, and we worked closely together until his death in 2013. Engelbart's entire career was based on an epiphany he had in the spring of 1951. He had just gotten engaged and was working at NACA, the precursor to NASA, in Mountain View, California. He'd come a long way from his Depression-era childhood in rural Oregon, where he spent his days roaming the woods and tinkering in the barn. He realized he had achieved both of his major life goals, a good job and a good wife. He pondered what he should aim for next. Then it hit him. It just went click, he told me later. If in some way you could contribute significantly to the way humans could handle complexity and urgency, that would be universally helpful. He had a vision of people sitting in front of computer monitors, using words and symbols to develop ideas and then collaborate. If a computer could punch cards or print on paper, he said, I just knew it could draw or write on a screen, so we could be interacting with the computer and actually do interactive work. At the time, there were relatively few computers in the world. The University of California at Berkeley was building one, so he went there for his PhD. He earned several patents, and in 1962, while working at the Stanford Research Institute, he published a paper titled Augmenting the Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework. At its core was the idea that computers could augment human intelligence. He outlined innovative ways of manipulating and viewing information and then sharing it over a network so people could work together. When he demonstrated this revolutionary idea in 1968, why didn't he get the response he'd been hoping for? I got some insight into this when I interviewed some of the engineers who attended his demo. They told me they had been awestruck, but that nothing he described had any relation to their jobs. He was asking them to take too big a leap, from doing calculations on punch cards to creating a new information superhighway. In the mid-1970s, Engelbart's lab, which he called the Augmentation Research Center, used government funding to support the quickly growing ARPANET. In a highly unorthodox move, he hired young women who'd graduated from Stanford with degrees in fields like anthropology and sociology. Engelbart, who had three daughters himself, believed that women were ideally suited to building new cultures. He sent his new hires out to other institutions to build networked improvement communities. This got him in a lot of trouble. The ARPANET's funders couldn't see why real people needed to support users. They saw his hires as a sign of failure. His systems weren't easy enough to use on their own. What Engelbart failed to communicate was that these women weren't just teaching people which keys to press. He wanted them to bring together thinkers who could, collectively, change the way the networks collected and analyzed information. Before long, the government reduced his funding, foreshadowing the end of his Augmentation Research Center. Later in the 1970s, Engelbart lost his key engineers to Xerox PARC Lab, a lavish and well-funded research center a few miles away. At the head was Alan Kay, 15 years Engelbart's junior, an upbeat, brilliant guy who knew how to inspire people. The laboratory chief was Engelbart's former funder from ARPA, Robert Taylor. For Engelbart, networks had always been an inextricable part of his vision. But under Kay's direction, the engineers created a personal computer geared toward individual productivity rather than collaboration. Their software included more user-friendly versions of a few of Engelbart's original ideas, including multiple windows, text with integrated graphics, and the mouse. A cruel joke of the time was that Engelbart's Augmentation Research Center had been a training program for PARC. In 1979, Xerox allowed Steve Jobs and other Apple executives to tour its labs twice in exchange for the right to buy 100,000 shares of Apple stock. Once Jobs began working on these ideas, they became even more streamlined. Engelbart's mouse had three buttons, which he used in different combinations to perform a range of tasks. After licensing this invention from the Stanford Research Institute, Apple decided it would be simpler to give it just one button. Engelbart lamented that the mouse's capability had been dumbed down to make it, quote-unquote, easy to use. Ironically, the mouse was the one invention that earned Engelbart widespread recognition, though it never earned him more than an initial lump sum of $10,000 from the Stanford Research Institute. He was bewildered that the simplest artifact from his grand vision had been the most widely embraced. After all, he'd foreshadowed just about everything Apple and Microsoft went on to create, at the time when Jobs and Bill Gates were just 13 years old. Alan Kay himself once remarked, "I don't know what Silicon Valley will do when it runs out of Doug's ideas." Engelbart's refusal to compromise was one of the main reasons he had a hard time gathering momentum. He often just ended discussions by declaring, "You just don't get it." That catchphrase cost Engelbart dearly. His detractors snidely remarked that the great component of collaboration was, ironically, unable to collaborate. I myself was at the receiving end of Engelbart's insults on several occasions, but no matter how irritably he behaved as a colleague, I knew he had great love for me as a person, and I understood why he often felt so frustrated. As I saw it, his ideas were so ahead of their time that there was often no language to describe them. When I asked him in 2006 how much of his vision had been achieved, Engelbart answered, about 2.8%. Because his system was designed to present the same information from different angles, it was more than a rudimentary version of the software we use today. I believe it was better equipped than Apple's or Microsoft's programs to solving problems like peace, income inequality, sustainable development, and climate change. He designed it for sophisticated knowledge workers, writers, designers, data analysts, economists. Even Google's collaborative apps are less ideally suited to do serious work that integrates libraries of data, documents, graphics, text, and information maps. Engelbart's system came with a learning curve, but he believed the result was worth it. When people praised other software for being more intuitive, he asked them whether they'd rather ride a tricycle or a bicycle. Although he earned over 40 awards, including the National Medal of Technology and Innovation, the $500,000 Lemelson MIT Prize, and several honorary doctorates, Engelbart often felt demoralized. He died in 2013 after suffering from kidney failure. But many of us are still inspired by his dream. As a professor, I've brought his ideas to the classroom and seen them change the way my students think. As one of them wrote in a letter to our university president, team members are thinking together and tapping into the collective IQ to augment individual performance. And the whole of our group is much greater than the sum of its parts. It is an exhilarating and rewarding experience. Even in this interconnected age, the world could use more of that. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I am Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.